some of the executive levels were, I mean, executives were then suspended and investigations were undertaken, and some of them were charged with different charges. And during that process, and with the interventions of CSSA, able to unblock some of the blockages that were picking up within the institution and also being raised by departments as we're engaging with departments, meeting with departments, and being faced with other departments that were even requesting to leave CETA and approaching cabinets to be allowed to procure services outside the CETA Act. We had to make those interventions that you highlighted here, which were given at the level of the board by board committees to ensure that we do a block. We are convinced that those interventions have assisted us in a number of areas where we have made progress as per the report that we attended today, Chair. And we are based now, as we report, by the end of the financial year, we had a full complement of the board. We have started recruiting for executives, and most of the executives have now been appointed and are within the organization performing their functions as we talk. And the challenges in CETA, perhaps Chair, before the CEO's done, will always continue. One of the things that we've identified as the board, I've often used the principle that we use in business, the 80-20 principle, that unfortunately CETA, probably if one were to look at the time we spend on procurement, we would say 20% of what we do is procurement and 80% is service delivery to departments and all of that. But 80% of the challenges that CETA has are procurement challenges. And the 80% of the work that we do and where there are also very good stories of success tends to overshadow by the 20% of the procurement work that we do because of challenges within the institution itself, but also because in many instances, even industry doesn't come to the party to play its role in ensuring that we were able to address some of the challenges. We have implemented initiatives that include ensuring that there is proper security vetting for people that are working in key areas. We have implemented initiatives to ensure that there's proper monitoring of business interest and disclosure by employees, as well as knowing their next of kin, business interests, especially those that are involved in the value chain within the SCM. There are some of the initiatives that the CEO will touch in the presentation, but where we are, I think there as some of the highlights we'll make through the CEO will indicate that there are areas where we're beginning to see some turnaround, and as of the end of the financial year, we're beginning to see those, and we hope when we come in this at the end of this financial year, we'll even be able to present better progress in those areas. Thank you.
Since chairperson of the board, so that is clear what I'm referring to now. And chairperson, I will just go through the presentation pretty quickly so that I allow more time for engagement. The first utilization reconfirm the position of CETA that we are still committed to the mandate that we established for in ensuring that we enable governments to deliver services at a lower cost, ensure efficiencies through the use of technology, ensure security of all of those things, and drive down the cost of service delivery. And this slide essentially looks at the journey where we've been, a lot of the things, and I think the chairperson has covered quite a lot of the things. And also talks to things that we have had that have been working well, that are continuing to work well within CETA, irrespective of the feedback and the perception that we have as an institution. We do have a number of projects that are working pretty well, most of our clients. Even in the procurement phase in the past financial year, as an example, we've had quite a few projects that were critical to the clients that we're working with. Department of Environmental Affairs just last week they have launched the new building. If we did not intervene in the procurement process that resulted in that building being connected properly and all of the IT space put in, it would not have been launched on time. It would, that project was at risk of not being delivered. Home Affairs had a similar project that needed to be delivered in the smart IT space. We did that. The government pension administration agency also had critical projects that needed to be delivered by the beginning of this financial year in February. Again, we came to the party and made sure that we deliver those things in time. So some of the issues that the plan has achieved also reflect the successes that have been made, and I must emphasize, as a result of the work that was done in the Ashesha project that the chairperson has spoken about. And that Ashesha project was very, very critical in ensuring that all of the weaknesses that the organization has, the basic principle, premise on which the board established the Ashesha was that it was impossible to achieve the goals that were in the APP unless you address the weaknesses that the organization faces. And a lot of work was done in that regard and covered, I think, officially 425 of the report. Going specifically to the APP, there were 39 APP items that were there. I must mention that we say 11 achieved. In fact, it's 10 achieved. If you look on M27, I think, I can't remember the page now. It's M27.
It's on page 29.
On page 29. It was referring to a clean audit without emphasis. We still have a qualified, we still have an unqualified report, but we still have methods of emphasis. So that can't be an achieved. It's a partially achieved. We apologize for that, but this is the picture. So in as far as these indicators are concerned, the performance is not what it could be. But this is interesting, when I talk about the financial, the revenue numbers, and I'll come back to this issue and go to the revenue numbers, there is a story that is beginning to emerge, the stabilizing relationship between ourselves and the client. We should reflect in the service delivery space, and at this stage it's not. The second issue that I want to make a point here, and I think it came earlier in the discussion with the department, the 39 indicators. We put, I think, a lot of indicators instead of focusing on the key indicators that drive the organization and make the organization more successful. And there's work that we are doing to try and refine and make sure without losing any issue that is important to the organization, but streamline the indicator. And that work, when it's finished, we will take it through the board and, if necessary, bring it to the committee so that the committee can then allow us to review the APP for the current financial year. But this is the picture in relation to the issues relating to the past financial year. And at the back of this is discussion of work that was done, in which a lot of effort was put. On the mid-targets, we've been putting our efforts irrespective of the fact that some of the targets may not have been framed properly. We said the targets are there, we need to address them. The issues relating to data sale and credit sale, we've put interventions in place to do that. We're implementing a debt management tool so that we can be able to understand our data and collect them properly. On the credit card, we needed to clean the data properly. There are two issues in the data. We needed to know the contractual arrangements that we have so that we can calculate how long does it take us to pay our credit card as compared to what we have contracted. Because the treasury regulation talks about saying within 30 days or in accordance with the contract arrangements that we have. So we needed to clean the data. That information wasn't clear at all. Hence, it was difficult to calculate that. But also we need to separate that data so that we've got a much tighter target in relation to how quickly we pay creditors who are part and parcel of smaller medium enterprises. And that information was not clear and the whole could not separate. The expenditure on CAPEX was slow because of bad planning. We're still a little bit slow this year, but there are projects that are in place. The new executives that have come forward have been tapped to design an alternative intervention that's not only going to address spending on the CAPEX, but also going to address the issues which that CAPEX is supposed to address in relation to our infrastructure. The other projects that we were supposed to deliver on, the project on cloud computing, that tender had problems throughout the process of our mission and got to a point where it had expired and we needed to cancel it. We're analyzing the specifications, updating those specifications so that we can go back to the market again on that. We had other targets that were relating to training that relates to the establishment of the ICT Academy. Because of the emergence of the National School of Government, we need to take a stock and pause and say, should we not align our activities with those of the National School of Government and make sure that this project is done in accordance with that? And we have done that alignment at the moment. But training is continuing, nonetheless. But we have to make sure that that training is also included in the curriculum of the National School of Government, and there are meetings with the School of Government to address that. Then there's the capability maturity model index that we had said that we will gain a level 3 certification this year. The context here is that we gained the level 2 certification last year. Normally it takes a few years before you do another assessment where you can get the level 2, level 3 certification. And we didn't do that certification because we're implementing the improvement that we suggested in the last year's assessment where we got the level 2 accreditation. And in 2015, 2016, it's only then that we're going to go for the certification. But we are doing an internal assessment at the moment that will be a report on that will be submitted to the executive as well as to the board by the end of March. We also needed to automate certain processes within the entity. Those processes, the automation of those processes is underway. We had challenges with the service provider, we have met with the service provider, we have said to the service provider, this matter must be resolved by the end of the financial year. It is not resolved by the time we go out on tender and get new service providers in order to move on this. And then we had a target, and this target, again, not to make an excuse, but it's a target around high-performance organization. We said we're going to improve this by 25%. And we did an assessment this year, we achieved a 4.67% improvement. And the company that is doing the assessment came and said to us, how did you guys set up a target of 25%? Nobody anywhere set up that kind of target. The benchmark target is about 5%. Now, if you look at it that way, we're pretty close to that target. But be that as it may, we have set it 25%, and therefore we did not achieve that target. The best employer to work for, we didn't achieve the target, but all of the policies that were needed were done. And in this regard, the market has not achieved. And the top employers institute gave us an award at the beginning of this month in this category. So it seems that the work that we have done was in fact good enough in the eyes of an external party. But internally, because that there's still some issues that we need to address and that work and improve. The supplier satisfaction index issues, we have done the assessment in this regard. We also don't think that we should continue with this indicator. Instead, we should monitor our performance on the service level agreement. Because if our performance on the service level agreement is good, and our customers are saying that performance is good, that says that it's a proxy and it's a lead indicator to the customer satisfaction we should do after the fact in any event. So this indicator was not achieved, but in this year we're using the service level agreement indicator to deal with this issue. In the supply chain space, we talked about automating some of the processes. We have automated our contract management. We have automated part of the procurement transactions that we put in a project plan. But all of these automations were done after the 31st of March. In fact, they were done in July and in August this year. So this is what that we've done as an intervention to resolve those issues. And now we are able to report that most of the turnaround times in procurement, if you exclude those transactions that were there at the beginning of March, all of those ones that came this year are all within the time frames. So it seems the work is working well. And then the amount of money that we spent on small and medium enterprises. The difficulty in this one was the ability to calculate that figure. We know all of our suppliers, but we do not segment them properly. And therefore, had we calculated the figure and provided a figure, it would not be a realistic figure or an accurate figure. So we've now segmented our suppliers, and the project of ensuring that calculation works and works well will finish by the end of this current financial year, and that segmentation process is being done. But these are targets that were not met, and the processes that we put in place in order to address those. The audit report, it was an unqualified audit report, as I said, the presentation that you have in front of you, on the left-hand column at the bottom, it says we reduced the regular expenditure from 128 to 28. Let me correct that. It's 144 million to 35, and there is a note in the financial statement that addresses that. There was just an error in putting the presentation together. The issues relating to the additional methods that the Water General has put in place and all of the performance information and the compliance issues, we have put all of those items into a dashboard. The last time we were in front of the committee asked that we provide that dashboard. My understanding is that it was sent, and we are monitoring all of the issues in relation to the method that the Water General has raised, would it improve the performance in the organization. Coming to the financial information, I just go through each. I'm not going to hand over to the CFO, he'll answer the questions. In the current financial year, our profitability was under pressure. The biggest driver in this was two key issues. One is that in November last year, the cabinet decided that the project on IFMS needed to be discontinued in the form it was and started afresh with a new architecture. And the result of that is that we had had investments in the IFMS over the past few years, and we had to write off those investments, write off some point of those investments, because there isn't any foreseeable cash flows from that project. But once the IFMS project kicks off again, we'll be able to recoup some of that value that was lost in that regard. There is a discussion between ourselves and the Treasury and the GP and the GPSA in as to how do we utilize some of that investment and be able to get some cash flows on. Once that project has been done and concluded, we will then be able to realize something. So that is one amount that, in fact, affected our performance here. And the other amount is that in the network phase, we have cut our prices to some degree, and therefore that has put pressure on our profitability. Other than that, the organization still continues to be in a sound footing, at least with its revenues exceeding its costs. I talked about our performance in terms of performance indicators that seems to be to have come down. But our revenues come up from the previous year. And this goes to the issues that Chair Bedner was talking about. In terms of the infrastructure project, we needed to focus on ensuring that our clients are engaged so that they regain confidence in CETA and so on. And we've seen that they paid the dividends because the revenue has gone up. You must remember that by June, July last year, we had notices of 1.5 billion rand of revenue that was going to be taken off, which means that our revenue should have gone down to 2.8 billion, but we were able to turn and create some confidence with our customers through a different engagement with them, which has helped us to retain at least the current levels of revenue if you look at the previous year. The net assets continue to appreciate, although it seems to be leveling off in the past year. So essentially the story is we have had challenges, have identified what the weaknesses are, we've addressed a lot of those weaknesses, yet that has not translated into performance in terms of service delivery in the past financial year, but we're beginning to see a different engagement, a different enthusiasm in the organization, a different engagement with our clients that set us in a path that is going to help us increase our revenues in the future. In fact, in this financial year, I've had a few discussions of opportunities with various clients which indicate that these figures are going to begin to increase. So we think that our mandate is likely to be achieved. We are likely to be able to get back to why we were established in the first place, aggregate government demand and drive the cost of service delivery down and create efficiencies for government. Those are the interventions, Chair, that we have done, and that is the picture of the report. I will pause at this point so that we can take questions.
Thank you very much. Let's take comments, questions, honourable members. Honourable Shin, honourable Nomieni, honourable Kilian. Honourable Shin, let's choose that I see all of the mic, if you don't mind. Are you able to? Yes, I'm coming to the object. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. So just an opening comment on the conclusion. The second point, you said teachers poised to become the ICT provider of choice. I just realized it was a choice. Some people get sued if they don't choose Peter. I just thought I would mention that. They get sued. They get sued with legal action if they don't choose Peter. I'm referring to the Western Cape. That there's forced to buy down with Peter. Right. I'm not going to leave that alone. We all know the incredible stress that every government department is under right now to reduce costs. Now, one of the major costs they have, those who deal with it, is your rather generous gross profit margin of, everybody just call it 18%. Are you, in the interest of camaraderie with the rest of the government department, going to reduce that gross profit margin so that they can all reduce their expenditure targets? So we all have a better government and spend that money rather on their end service delivery. I was looking at, this is now page 70, of the annual report, the employment vacancies. Now, Office of the CEO is supposed to have 21 people, and there are 6 vacancies. Now, I just wonder, why do you need 21 people in your office? Good PA and a key maker or whatever. I don't know. I'm ignorant. But I mean, is an office that now is really worthwhile? And corporate services, it also has 289. I wonder if that's really necessary. Obviously, the irregular findings and missed targets are quite apparent for everybody to see. This is on findings. Point 29 on page 83, it's page 29 and 31. Strange reporting, unable to obtain information due to the fact that the auditee could not provide sufficient appropriate evidence in support of this item. And then another one, I'm just wondering what is being done on improving the quality of the people you're employing in these very critical jobs. That to me is quite important. Then on page 84, there were people who didn't, the election of the accounting authority was not, this is 438 on page 84. Persons in service of the public entity had private business interests, failed to disclose such. Deviated or approved by the accounting authority, even though it was impressive, not too advised competitive bids. Point 40, persons in the public service entity whose close family members had private business interest contracts awarded did not disclose as such. Bidders not declaring that they were employed by the staff. Contracts awarded to bidders who did not submit a declaration that they had their previous conditions under afforded and that sort of thing. What has been done, to the individuals concerned? What action has been taken against those people? And are they still employed? And was there any material sort of fraud or anything coming from that? We have expenditure management that is also on page 85 that comes under a fair amount of criticism. Non-profit record keeping, all those sort of things that you can actually see explained with any people have been removed from their posts or, you know, you can't get a people to do the job. Now, when one goes on again of instance of a regular expenditure, I mean, it's actually quite amazing. Well, it's 35 million. Yeah, is it? Yeah. 35 million rand on the regular expenditure there. Sorry, just give me a moment. Yeah. There was 25 million lost going. I'm talking about 132 now. Page 132 is the annual report. Details of irregular expenditure condoned. Now you've written off 24 million. In stuff you couldn't recover. Particularly, disciplinary action could not be instituted if the responsible official no longer in Peter's employ. That happens twice, down point 3 and point 5. then this really actually is against two senior officials who issued a formal warrant at point four. That was for an amount of 16 million rand. Are these officials still employed? Because I would think that would be quite a serious accusation. And as why, if they are, I mean, if you ripped it off, why are they still employed? And this has all been condoned by the board, so I feel it's all up for illegal. But when so often, you know, all these guys do change jobs, and they've put some other jobs in the SC, and they do the same thing there, and it never appears on their employment records. So these guys will keep circulating. Financial statements, the page on 34, 35. What are the ad hoc payments to the board members of half a million rand? Because then that's excluding the tables and fees for directors, and we don't get to talk. And there's another one here. Travel allowances is on page 136-37. This was Supi. It's about 1.2 million. Travel allowances are 168,000. Other allowances are 25. That's, I would think, quite excessive. And you have a lot of travel expenses here, 151,000, 200,000. To the acting executive of the supply chain management. Why is so much travel? And then they're going to look at this. Oh yeah, this is the 600,000 rand on travel allowances to the executive committee members. And other allowances were 234,000. Can you please have some detail as to what those other allowances are? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got two questions. What has been put in place to ensure that in future the settlement creditors will seem to dedicate to their heads to? On another part, page 84, it raises significant issues related to procurement. What has been done to respond to the concern of AG? Thank you.
We welcome the presentation, and I just want to, you know, emphasize the fact that we really have a concern about the action of the CEO, like I said before you explained, but still, it doesn't change the fact that you are really concerned. But the question was, you know, about the ability of the department if you do not have a CEO. Although you have explained, but the concern still remains, and we hope that, as you promised, you will really implement as required. And out of this 1127 employees, that's page 22, and the challenges, it will be the sixth paragraph, I think. You know, in the HR matter, when staff is on the field under stress because of the imminent restructuring or transformation or limit, we already have DAP, whether people go through counseling, you know, to boost their morale. Otherwise, they're going to have a problem with their performance because of the insecurity. And here, I don't know what happened to the current status of this 1,127. And I think I agree with them on the issue of extensive use of labor brokers and consultants. You can choose labor brokers, you really don't know who your employer is. You go to the actual employer, the person tells you, no, you are brought by a labor broker. You go to the labor broker, the labor broker says, no, I'm sitting on the job, so I'm out of it. So people are left in between. And let them participate with delivery and public image as well, or public service generally, so to say. And I just expect something about the EAP. And again, we have a question again on non-compliance and regular expenditure, things like that. Where do people choose to do what is wrong? It comes, you know, from time to time. If it's not addressed, it's really negligent. And the system is stipulated what should be done when an official or country officer is negligent. It comes from time to time. We have all this explanation how it happens and measures that are going to be taken to remedy the situation. But come the next day, and of course we still have it again. Why do people choose to do the wrong thing? Can we have maybe some indication as to what you have a situation whereby someone has been taken to task for being negligent or for choosing to do what is wrong? Because I think the question is, people who are employed according to what you see in the report here, are people who are qualified in terms of what they are doing. We don't know why they have all the qualifications that is required, but also wanting to do the wrong thing. I think other issues have been alluded to by those who spoke before me, but I go on and on and on. And I think you always have a way, you know, of just going in between that and just leave us disempowering some of the questions, because just by putting the information, the input, and it actually talks to the concerns that are raised in the initial presentation. The same presentation, it will come some answers already, so it may not really make sense to continue to ask them, but really, we hope that what you are saying that you're going to do, really implement. Thank you.
Jefferson, first of all, thank you for the presentation. And unfortunately, we have to say that so often in Parliament we get a so-called turnaround strategy, and it appears, and we are hopeful that this time it's going to settle in and stay there. And so often we are so bitterly disappointed. So please pardon us if we look at the report, we identify serious deficiencies, and we say, yes, you've given an indication that at least you recognize the difficulties, but and you intend to solve them. But please understand, if we are very skeptical, that we will in fact turn the ship around. So first of all, I want to read with some of my colleagues and who expressed their concerns about the AG report and serious deficiencies in respect of every element of the audit that was conducted, which were identified. Now, Honourable Sotetsi has already highlighted, and Honourable Shin as well, but I must just refer to, let me just quickly not confuse myself, just want to quickly refer to the audit report and ask a question about what you are doing to make sure that your information and that your performance information is accurate, that you establish on the basis of 80-20, what are the critical elements of a performance plan that you have to spell out for next year with clear, measurable goals and achievable goals. Don't come with pie in the sky. You know, what is that 20% that you must do to turn the ship around 80%? So I think I wanted to ask that. But then looking on page 84 and 85, of the annual report, members have referred to procurement, and these are very serious transgressions of supply chain management. It absolutely flies in the face of the Constitution of South Africa, what people have presented themselves with. Now, I'm concerned because if I look at that and I look at the investigations, etc., reports of the Auditor General, and I go further and I look at your HR report, and two, it's evident that your institution is a culture. There's a serious problem with the culture. There are insecurities. I mean, people are concerned because they see you things up. First question is, do you have all your performance contracts in place? Do they clearly stipulate what every person, because you've got a big organization, total at end of March is 3,183. Everyone in the institution, do they know what their responsibilities are? And are they held accountable? Secondly, if I look at the number of vacancies that are remaining, when will you reach the position, the point, that you will say, in terms of competing demands for government money, when will you assess your workload, if you have operated without certain positions, and I'm not talking about key positions, I'm talking about other positions, is it not time for you to rationalize as well? To bring stability, yes, but to make sure that you rather focus on those critical positions that will help you turn the ship around. And just as a matter of interest, I note on page 71, it says settlement signed labor relations. Where will we see the amount of the settlement? That was signed, or was that a secret settlement that is part of court procedures, legal terms? Is that perhaps the previous CEO? Will you please inform us about that situation? And then if we look at the number of employment changes, 253, it is quite significant that you've had 111. Do you conduct exit interviews, or are those people who are fleeing because of irregularities that have committed that CEO? And that brings me to the point that Honourable Shin has raised, namely page 132. You know, the Public Finance Management Act is very clear what should happen to people who are not honest employees of the state and who should be held accountable. How can we, will you please tell us, if you have just simply accepted to discipline, stop disciplinary action, and will you, what steps are you taking to ensure that the same people are not just recirculating in the public sector? I know there was one of the ministers of the Public Service and Administration who at some stage, and I can't remember if Honourable Pravin Gordhan also noted it, he at least mentioned it the other day for local government. He was thinking of some other list that should be kept with ID numbers of people who have really had a very poor history in the public service, who should not be appointed in the public service, again, in any institution, be it national, provincial, or local. And that is the only way that we will root out this culture of negligence and also corruption in the public sector. So please tell us about that and inform us what steps you are taking to correct the internal culture in CETA. Otherwise, next year, we will have to brace ourselves for just another report with another number of non-achieved objectives and goals, and then again, certainly reasons why you couldn't achieve this back in the following year and why people left the organization. Thank you, Jess.
Thank you very much. Maybe that's a gift to the team.
Hey, thank you very much, Chair. I also welcome the presentation, but I just want to raise a few points of emphasis, Chair, in line with other honorable members. The issue of procurement, I think it's on page 84. If you look at it, the AG raised more points than any other item, 36 to 42, which becomes important then to assure honourable members in terms of interventions or your understanding of this challenge from the up to a current status in terms of procurement officer state of security clearance. I think we did check that really when we visited the department. In other words, guarantees of non-reputation, they become critical since this seems to be your core business. The second point, I think often when there are challenges with procurement procedures, one often finds that the cost to the state to buy these equipment is very high. We had colleagues saying it's cheaper to buy a computer from a retail store than to procure it in government. So it becomes a challenge because then it means there are no benefits from our buying power. And all over the world, the more you buy from entities, the more the bulk buying makes it cheaper for you. So those are some of the challenges which I think could give assurance to government as a whole if they are addressed and make it affordable, these expensive equipment. Because if we don't address it, it affects the quality of the core. It affects the delivery. Also on page 83, there seem to be a finding relating to ICT, SME, and ICT industry role, where I think that in the auditor general was not happy. And of course, from a transformation agenda point of view, it's one area which becomes important for us that we have to get clarity as to what the understanding, what might have been challenges, and what is the way forward. There was even an issue of establishing an operational ICT academy, which I was not, I'm not sure they was meant to assist new entrants, an incubation of some kind. So again, the challenge is like we're not thinking sustainability if we are neglecting empowerment interventions and possibility of opening up the industry to those who otherwise they would not enter on their own without government support. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a couple of issues for me. I think, let me just follow properly so that I don't lose track of what I want to raise. I think for me, we appreciate this presentation. Starting with the performance against the terminal offices, and I think indeed, CEO, my observation on this one is similar to what I said to the department. I think as well, it has really just gone too broad and everywhere. And we we'll look forward to that reconfiguration of the target and what to achieve and be able to focus the institution. But another thing that is concerning me around the performance here is what is planned versus what is budgeted for. Because if you look at your performance, for example, let me just go to M29, implementation of knowledge management, partially achieved resource constraint. It becomes a problem for me if you plan and you can't put money into it. Otherwise, if you can, and this is what I said earlier on, you have 12 months, if you can't be able to budget for that particular year, therefore put it aside and say this is what we're going to do. Otherwise, you do what I was saying, this 2% here, 2% there, and almost nothing. Because it doesn't make sense to say you're putting something here, this is what, it's not only that one, even on the issues in insufficient funds, M6, for example, those are the things that are a bit of a challenge. Again, even your SME support as well remains a concern. If you look at on the annual report, page 26 now. So those for me are a bit of a concern as well, or I have concern in me. And as well for me, so when you say this, an explanation for me is not sufficient. Until you say to us, these are the things we have put in place. If you say we have put mechanisms, it's not yet sufficient. Because you've got to say, for us to be able to, I think we can teach what they would say, for us to be able to pay on the issue of DOC when it was responding, I'm not sure, I can't remember why that. For us to be able to pay the things that she does, this is what we are putting in place. So we will do this, maybe prior to our procurement, this is what we are going to do. These are the verification methods that we are going to put in place so that we are able to pay in time. So that's what needs to give us comfort, because SMM is degenerating. Our campaign is that government is killing them. SMM is our complaining that because we do not pay on time, they are unable to survive. So we say something else, but we act in its opposite direction. So it's out of all of us entities to be able to try and make sure that we support them. It's big businesses that might be able to survive after we don't pay them for a year. But an SMM relies on this money, because they're still growing, whether they're currently a small business. So we've got to be able to provide them with support to be able for them to survive. So we've got to be very clear in what, this is not just a wish thing, but it's because we want to survive. this development and want to see a transformational agenda happen. So that's why for me it's very, very interesting. And I'm glad you raised the issue of the target in terms of the clean audit. But again, if you actually look forward to evaluate your performance, 11 out of, it's now 10 out of 39 times, which is very low. It's good. And it can be, because if we are to say it needs to be the backbone, driving the backbone, ICT as the backbone of government, the performance and the safety delivery can be at risk level. It's very, very low. It has to look at that, because we want to be able to see at some point, so that we when we say to departments and to everyone else that it's a much utilized data, we must have your house in order. Because it doesn't help to force people to come and utilize your system when you are disorganized. It doesn't help us. But the other thing, maybe think of what you need to explain is the surplus, if you can go into the surplus to settle on page 2. What is the surplus? Just explain so that we know what the surplus in terms of that. Let us say surplus before tax, the one in terms of page 36. And then we move to okay, let's get to other things should have been raised by my colleagues. I think the issue of the vacancy rate is a concern. 902 of this. What I'm concerned about, especially for me, is that you've got 902 vacancy rate versus, I think what the colleagues spoke about is the honorable vacancy. Versus the people who are sitting in the pool. Because that's what I'm worried about. You have that number of people, I think it's in the earlier pages. Page 22, where you're speaking about 1,127 employees out of 2,671, which for me as well does not correspond, CEO, with the 183 that is to section page. So if you say your total employees is 2,671, and the other side is 3,183, is this in combination with this 1,127? The two numbers. But as well, if you have 902 vacancy rate with 1127 people sitting in the pool, what does this mean? Are these 1127 people sitting in the pool because they do not have the necessary skills to fit into this profile that I get in terms of the vacancies of 902? That needs to be clarified. Then we go to the audit report signed and sent by the chairperson of the audit committee, page 78, whereas when there are matters that are highlighted there. If you look at that, and I think maybe let me just highlight both the paragraph that starts with both internal and external audit commission to identify several instances of non-compliance with law and regulations pertaining to procurement purposes, contract management, and adherence to internal control. And that's the sentiment I said earlier on. We can't have entities that do not comply with the law. That can never happen. Where I see, for me, I see laws and regulations that are not followed is a red flag for me. Because it's just a celebration. And you look at the concern noted with concern that only 28% of the full corporate balance contract was achieved by the entity. That's what I read later on. And I think if as entities as well, we really take serious the work of the internal audit and the auditor general or external auditor, it will help. Because what they pick up, and because if you have these people who are internal audit and are part of the institution, surely you should be able to listen to them what they are raising. And by the time we have an audit, but if the things that are raised here by the internal audit are almost the same things that are raised by the auditor general, the mechanisms through the board must be put in place today. Once the audit committee picks up issues, they must respond to it. So that it will come in at the tail end and they are still ready to go. Committee is like this, the board is not doing it over time. Because if it's a committee raises this thing, and the age later raises the same thing, there's a problem. That's for me. So you can't have that. So I've raised the issue of that. And then we come to even the issue of performance CEO, where the auditors are saying that evidence could not be provided when they were checking the reliability of the reported performance information of SMPTAN. For me, that's a problem. Because if you are able to do that, it means that the reporting mechanism internal controls are a problem, are not done properly. And that's why I'm emphasizing both such and other comments and reports. Then I think the Minister of Race and GM has raised the issue of procurement. But what it means, that there are things that have been raised here, which I think are more concerned here. The issue of non-declaration by staff members in terms of the contracts or the companies that they have. Because what it raises, you see, we've got governments have been raising the issue of dealing with corruption. And for me, this flex is a red flag for me. If we have, for example, if we let's go to what the AG is raising. For example, if I think those things, it's not something that we can just goods and services with transactions to the value of 500 were for sure if not obtained. The required price quotation. Breaking general regulations. Goods and services of transactions value about 500 were for sure if not inviting competitive bids as required by treasury regulations. Breaking regulations. Deviations were approved by accounting authority when even though it was not impractical to invite competitive bids in conservation with treasury regulations. Pattern in service of public entities who had a private or business interest in contracts awarded by public entity failed to disclose such interest as required. What action was taken here? Pattern in service of the public entity whose family, close family members, partners or associates had a private or business interest in contracts awarded by the public entity failed to disclose such interest as required by treasury regulation. What action has been taken here? Contracts were awarded to bidders who did not submit a declaration on whether they are employed by the state or contracts connected to any person employed by the state, which is required in order to comply with treasury regulation. Contracts were awarded to bidders who did not submit a declaration of past supply chain practices such as fraud, abuse of supply chain system and underperformance, which is required in order to comply with treasury regulation. I'm emphasizing this because these regulations are there for examples and they need to be adhered to. If we are serious about combating corruption in the public service, in government, these things should not happen. It can't be correct that we have these things, that's why the person I want to know what actually has been done. When you found that a contract has not declared, what has happened? What are the consequences that has been taken? Because there can be breaking of the law and there are no consequences for it. It doesn't work like that. It has to, everything that happens has to have consequences. If people break the law, they must have consequences. We can't sit here as legislators and leave them just like that. You need to know action has been taken. Otherwise, then the minister must take action against the board for not holding on the issues, because that's what the law says. Then, I don't know if I think one of the colleagues should have asked this, but just to be sure, the post-retirement employee benefit, just explain what is that. I tried to understand the terms of the footnote, I couldn't. I read it through and I thought, I just want to be sure what my understanding is there. In page 90 of the annual report. Then the other thing that chairperson of the board I need to understand what is the status of the CEO's position. It was a contract, we were still wanted to be there for a time. Are we extending it? And I think one of the colleagues spoke about it, the issue of stability of the institution. Then the last thing, CEO or CFO. I'm looking at the board meetings in terms of this. There are, if I'm correct, if you combine shareholder meeting, board meeting, special board meeting and workshops, and other meetings, you have 28 in this financial year. Then you count, then you have the subcommittees of the board, there's 32 meetings. This for me is a bit of a problem. I'll tell you why. Because if you have main board meetings and activities of the board, if the board is operating within its budget, then what is budgeted for the board operation? What is the budget? The second issue is what chapter is. If we have many meetings, that's why we are trying to manage and balance between what we call entities. Because more than anything as well, we still need this executive to be able to deliver this. Because the oversight is there, it shouldn't be a blend line between the leadership and the board. I'm just concerned about the figure there that I see. And maybe it can be explained. But where are you sitting? This is a loss, because if you calculate 28 plus 32, it gives you almost 60 meetings per annum for the board. This is in page 48 and 49, if you count the meetings. Yeah, it's my calculation, it says the board activity is 60 meetings per annum. It's way too much. That we need to clarify. So, those are the questions that I had, and the sentiment that I wanted to say. We want to see CETA progressing, we want to see CETA really coming around. Got a very critical role to play, and we are going to have to sit on CETA leadership to be able to achieve its mandate. I'll give over to you to respond.
Chair, honourable members, thank you. Let me just respond to the last questions. I think we agree with the sentiments expressed by the honourable chair about the number of meetings. But I do, Chair, just want to place it on record that CETA was in crisis at the time, and when we implemented the CETA intervention, it was at the time when we were looking for a CEO, and it was at a time when we didn't have an executive team that could drive those interventions, and it required the board to actually get close to the coalface to deal with the issues. We've had to have a number of workshops to understand what are the issues. We, at board level, I had to lead delegations to meet with the DG clusters. We had to meet with, to go and present to cabinet. We had to go all out as a board to have an appreciation of what were the real challenges. In the first meeting that we had as the board with the employees of CETA, the employees didn't want at the time the management team that was in place to even be part of the meeting between the board and the employees of CETA. We had to take as a board a very firm position to say we wanted to raise issues in their presence. So the number of meetings that we see in this financial year are reflective of the crisis that has to be resolved at the time. Would I do it again if I have to? I certainly think share with an appreciation of the challenges. But now that we've got an executive team, clearly as the board, we are providing what is the role and responsibility of the board to provide leadership, oversight, and guidance to executive management. So I think we are addressing that issue, Chair. On the issue of the CEO position, we are engaged in discussions. We had discussions as a board. We started with discussions, but when there were changes in the shareholder representative with the new minister coming in, we had to allow an opportunity to engage with the new minister, and have already done so. There are discussions that are continuing between ourselves and the board and the minister, and to address this matter, and I'm certain that we should be able to resolve it soon. We are aware of the importance of stabilizing and settling the organization. I think, Chair, I may come in should the need arise, but I would like to allow the colleagues to come in. The CEO will deal with some of the issues, and probably the CFO and the other board members to come in.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe starting on a lighter note, while there's legislation that people must well consider, what we want to see is a scenario in which departments are not thinking about the legislation, but they're thinking about the service they get from CIDA in order to make a decision. Hence, the issue of choice. The questions can be grouped in a number of ways. There are questions that relate to cost reduction. And they came from different people, and also the comments from the Deputy Minister. We have identified the issue of cost reduction as a critical issue. And one of the things that we're saying is that our image at the moment is not helping that, because if people don't want to work through us, it fragments the government demand, which needs to be consolidated and drive economies of scale, and ensure that you are able to deliver on the cost reduction easily. But even without that, we have a project that we started in the last month or so, and that project focuses on the efficiencies in our contracting arrangement, as well as the manner in which we package the services that we deliver to departments. And in this regard, and I don't want to jump the gun and say this is the amount, but I can say without fear of contradiction to the committee that very, very soon, in the next 4 to 6 weeks, we will be able to be writing letters to departments saying that even though it's a small amount, in this line item, the costs are coming back by a significant amount, and we will be doing that in the next few months. And I'm saying this because we have identified the extent of inefficiencies, we have identified the extent to which the cuts are going to be, and we just finalizing all of the legal paperwork in order to make sure that it becomes a reality. So we are focusing in this area, and once this project is done, we're going to be moving to other line items that are bigger in order to make a much bigger impact. Then there are questions relating to the availability of information during the audit. It has still been a challenge that we've been facing. And I think the critical issue is what are we doing in order to deal with it. In relation to performance information, on a monthly basis, we have an internal verification process that we have established where whatever the claims of performance for that period are must be supported with evidence, so that by the time the auditors come, that evidence is available. There is no question of looking around for that evidence. It's readily available. And following up on that, we are up to date at the moment with that information. And if we were to audit it today, we would be able to produce it for the last reporting period. Then there's an issue around adhering to legislation, which comes from that paragraph 36 to 42 of the Auditor General's report. Two things. One, what are we doing to improve the system? And the second one is the PFMA is very clear that to the extent that those infractions, when they have been incurred, there needs to be a specific action. When we talked in the earlier presentation that we did, I can't remember when was it now, to the committee, we talked about what we're doing to improve procurement. All of the initiatives that we're doing there, they are meant to address this. All those interventions. among them is reviewing of the policies, reviewing of the processes, and the automation that I talked about. All of those things are being done, and they are meant to ensure that henceforth you don't have these challenges. But there is a question of people have violated the law, have they faced the consequences. Part of the reason why I did not have all of the executives is that in the second month in the office, some of the items that are related to those suspensions that were in the second month relate to the items that are on the paragraph 36 to 42. There's a few other actions that we took thereafter. And we looked at the highest possible individual that contributed to this, as opposed to going to the weakest link in the value chain. So there has been action taken, and to the extent that some of these we haven't been able to establish where the culpability lies, where the process of that establishment, and we will take action as is appropriate. So the issue with reporting that all of the good actions that we take, when we come to the reporting time, the report has to cover everything that happened during the run, irrespective of the action that would have been taken then. So there are actions that we are taking in relation to all of those. Travel allowance. We've had a look at this issue because we felt that these amounts are ridiculous. The first report that we did related in the current financial year, we picked up that there are these anomalies, and we have, in fact, where we picked up these anomalies on our own, we have disciplined at least two individuals, and one of them was fired, and the other one who was a junior, and it was improperly by the senior who was allowed to resign, but the senior was disciplined and fired. The issues relating to labor brokers, as part of the Ashesha project, the board decided that we need to address this issue, and we have addressed it in as far as it is concerned. The only people we have are contracted employees and not through the labor broker anymore. So that is history in as far as CETA is concerned. There was a question around if you were to do a few things that would make the legal impact at CETA, what will those things be? It's a sort of procurement, I think the chairperson did mention as well, that procurement is a small portion of our business, but it's got a bigger impact in terms of how our customers receive us, in terms of the challenges that we're facing. So procurement is one such. If we're to make sure that we address our infrastructure, our housing infrastructure, our network infrastructure, that can again be another intervention that will make a meaningful impact to our customers. And of course, linked with these two things is issue of the cost reduction, which I've just spoken about in terms of the project that we are doing, and we are pretty close to seeing the results of that. And then the question of holding people accountable, I think I've spoken about that. Then, Chairperson, the accounting officer's report refers to the employee numbers at the beginning of the financial year. The numbers on page 70, on page 70, relates to the future at the end of the year. 3,183 is the total number of posts at CETA. The number of vacancies is, in fact, a reflection of the number of vacancies. But the number of the head count at CETA, if you go to page 59, if you look at the top, there's a thing that says grand total. Full-time employees that are in the employment of CETA is 2,241 as of 81st of March 2014. 2,241. We then have contracted employees who have got 10 contracts, and they are 561 as of end of March, plus the interns, which makes up 56, and all of those numbers added together, they make 2,898, and then the difference will be the vacancy, which is about 10% of the establishment. So for some of the positions, we've got people that are contracted that are not full time in the organization. And for some, we are using interns whom we recruit full time once that is finished. So we are having challenges, obviously, for trying to fill the positions at the moment. We are not yet an appealing employer. We hope that the best employer award that we got will change that picture. And some of the initiatives that we are implementing, we're hoping that they will change that picture as well. The issue of people that are resigning or have resigned without action having been taken, and whether we can do anything as CISA to make sure that they don't get employed elsewhere, I think it's a policy question. That we need a dispensation that we would use to do that. In as far as the suppliers that we deal with, we have the switching process that is in the TSA. We've got the licensing that is in the Prevention of Corruption and Corrupt Activities Act. So you've got those Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. You've got those dispensations allowing us as the institutions to be able to do certain things. At the moment, in as far as employees are concerned, I think we need a dispensation that allows for that. But to the extent that they are still in the organization, we are able to deal with them. When they resign, it becomes a difficult issue to handle when the matter is still underway. Because resignation is a unilateral decision after all. So we deal with it to the extent that we can. The SMME issue, we do spend money on SMMEs, but the difficulty that we have is the ability to quantify what that amount is because we do not segment our information. We have worked on cleaning our data so that we are able to do that and make sure that we pay on time. So the payment is just a check. It is a crime when small enterprises are not paid on time because they rely on that cash flow in order to run their business, pay their salaries and so on. And therefore, if we're doing everything possible to make sure that that happens, I am confident that when we report at the end of this financial year, our numbers in this regard would be looking quite decent. May I have the Chief Financial Officer to address the issue of post-retirement? Before that, on the staff that is in the pool, it was 1,127 at the end of financial year, 142 as of today. It's not a number to be proud of because employees feel that are at risk and people are not secure in their jobs and want to make sure that this is addressed before the end of November. Yes.
The issue of the post-retirement mental health benefits, you have to go back to when CETA was established. Remember, it was a measure of a different number of organizations. And the post-merger integration, after the entities have been met, one of the things that you have to integrate is the conditions of service. And those conditions may be different for different class of employees from the institutions that they are coming from. So there was a certain group of employees whom their previous employer had undertaken to pay their mental aid benefits for life. So what happened is, on an annual basis, there's an actuarial valuation that looks at certain things like their life expectancy and so forth, and when are they likely to retire. So that amount then accrued as a liability, and that's what ends up in the post-retirement medical aid benefit. So some employees, when they reach retirement age, then that is paid out to them as a lump sum, or they elect that we continue paying their premiums for the rest of their lives.
There's one question that I did not answer, and it relates to the 24 million rand allotment of your regular expenditure. Both the regular expenditure, when the investigation takes place, we take into account the PFMA requirements that say that where it is appropriate to do so, take the action necessary. So in as far as we holding people accountable, by the time we present to the board, that determination would have been made whether that it helped in the case. Now the condoning of expenditure is not rational. What it simply says and that you committed an action. I went out and got something on behalf of Satan. But I was supposed to get the permission of the chairperson here in nursing, but I did not get that permission. So the condoning is getting that permission after the fact, having investigated and established what the consequences are. So it's basically the ratification of an earlier decision that had not followed the legislation, but we use the word condoning of that, of the regular expenditure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we are done with CETA in terms of the discussion. So we'll do a follow up on the issues because you've already made a lot of comments in terms of changing things. I hope you remember them. You know the commitments that we have made, we are going to follow them up, including what the chairman has set upon the position of the CEO chairman. We'll definitely follow up, especially because it's just where it comes from. That's why I'm raising it as a concern, because if you get an instability over time, because of leadership, because we don't want to say, when we are starting to make progress on certain matters, we regret. That's why it should be important, I mean, to really make sure that matters concluded sooner than later before we have progress, because we don't want to see that going backwards. We want to see it going forward. And stabilizing itself. And that is very important for us. We will definitely keep it posted. We'll look in terms of the legal process. I think the CEO raised about possibility of wanting to amend the current annual plan. We'll look at that in terms of what are the requirements. I think it should be allowed. But we can look at that to make sure that when we come to annual report, if you realize already, because otherwise you would experience the same thing come next year, the same thing. So if you realize already the case, that's what we must address now. So we make sure that I think we are allowed to do that. Given the time to present the stress lens, we are able to do that and adjust before we get concrete. But let's not go back and see, and maybe even teach you if that is the issue, we should be able to utilize it and see how we improve. Because we would want to have a different type of discussion come October 2015. We shouldn't rehearse what we have said today. Thank you very much. We'll go to what I call the new kid on the block, Port and Ifako. Welcome to our committee. I think we are interacting with you for the first time as this committee. And I think one of the things I'm asking to Port and Ifako, you must allow us, we might take longer with you because you must understand what you do, what your mandate is, in the process of us making sure that we hold you accountable. Unlike others, we have interacted with them before. We've had certain discussions with them, and we hope that you are finding our engagement interesting, and we are feeling welcomed to this table. And I think you are part of the important team. We came late into the team, but I think we all have a much responsibility. I think I'll give over to the chairperson. The CEO and the CEO. So over to you first, and then can you do the introduction and do your mark, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, thank you, chairperson. And I recognize the Deputy Minister and the Honourable Members in the House. As said by the Chairperson, we do comprise a new key to the block in the sense that we just last week in the AGM, and following the proclamation, we moved to the Department of Telecommunications. Chairperson, the presentation is not a long one. We start off simply by stating what the mandate of broadband infraco is in terms of the broadband infraco act, which is really twofold. In summary, is we have a legislative mandate, which is really to expand availability and affordability of access to electronic communication. And then it also goes into going into underdeveloped and underserved areas. And then also we have a commercial aspect where we have to find money to stay afloat, and on the basis of a going concern, keep ourselves going. So those are the two key mandates. And coming into the house for the first time, we'll have to learn what is it, as you said, that is required of us. So we're going to proceed on the basis of reporting to you as how best we thought we should report. I think over and above the bound report, the CEO and CFO prepared a short presentation. I must once again remember apologize for the chairperson of the audit committee who gave birth this morning to a baby, and that's why she could not come. Otherwise she would have been here. Yes, with your consent, with your authority, give over to the CEO.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, Honorable Deputy Minister, Honorable Members, Director General. As the Chair has indicated, we thought it appropriate for us to rehash and present our understanding of our mandate and where we fit in within the broadband value chain. The Act does talk to us expanding the availability and affordability of access to electronic communication. But most importantly, it should be noted that that availability is expanded to other operators, either licensed or licensed exempt. So we are on the supply side of the value chain and provide infrastructure to other operators. So if we move to slide 3, where we think we fit in, or the activities that we have been involved in, where do they fit in with regards to the broadband policy that was approved in December 2014. We believe that we play a critical role in digital readiness. We already do provide, we are a carrier neutral provider of infrastructure to Hotel C and Airtel. We do provision services for Vodacom and Airtel, and with other infrastructure players like Dark Fiber, Abica, and Fiberco, we are always engaging on how best to collaborate and not duplicate available infrastructure. With regard to the public collaboration, I think our turnaround strategy of 2012, we were requested to focus on government as an anchor tenant to see how we enable government and how we collaborate with other state-owned companies. And to that effect, from December 2012 to the end of July this year, we have managed to sign a strategic partnership with CETA. In this financial year, the current year that we are in, we have reached an agreement with USASA on how best we can assist and collaborate with each other to ensure that the underserved areas are served. For those folks that are not part of the ITT, like Eskom, Transnet, PASA, SANRA, we have engaged Eskom and agreed fiber allocation model because they do have ITT infrastructure. And what we are now working on is how best to fund the infrastructure that is available there. On Transnet, historical arrangement was such that we were not allowed into the Transnet open access point because of the way the agreement had been concluded initially, and it was thus our mandate to ensure that the contract is open up for us. With regard to PRASA, PRASA had an open tender to allow for various leaders to gain access to their infrastructure, and we are currently concluding a contract with them that is based on a pay-as-you-use model. We have engaged various provinces as part of digital development to find out and engage with them on how best we can collaborate with them. In most provinces, we do engage through the Department of Economic Development. We share with them
their plans, and they share with us their plans. And this has resulted in us having a memorandum of agreement with the province of Limpopo. And for both the provinces of Limpopo and Mpumalanga, we have submitted documents to the infrastructure grant so we can do a pre-feasibility study together. And in these engagements, the last mile provision of services is mainly to be done within the province, as we see that as an area for economic transformation, and our role is being mainly on the bus backhaul infrastructure. As Honourable Chairperson had indicated, Parliament has said the same, so we decided to report on some of the information that we have presented to the previous portfolio committees so that we have consistency. So on slide number 4, as part of our mandate, which is to expand access, and access we measure it based on the number of open access points that we have. We also measure the kilometers of fiber that we have. Our mandate talks to and in line with the new growth part, regional connectivity. So from 2012 to 2014, our focus has not been that much on ensuring that we have lots and lots of kilometers of fiber, but it has been on ensuring that the fiber that we have and the equipment that we have can sustain the customers that we have. The access points that we have, I must correct that on the slide, we have 160 POPs, 52 POPs. It should actually be 158 as it is in the annual report. We have today connected all the direct neighboring countries. Last year when we presented, we did not have Botswana connected. So we are connected on the West Africa cable system as well as all our regional neighbors, and we do have traffic moving in that network. From a business operations point of view, in 2012 we had promised Parliament that we would have an operational system and a business system. It has taken us a while, but I am pleased to announce that for this current year, whilst we do have an ERP that is in place, it does not necessarily support what we need to do. So we started off by implementing phase one, which is focusing on the HR aspect, and are in the process of ensuring that all of our processes within the company are defined and implementing systems within our network operating center, upgrading what we have. Okay. Parliament raised concern about the security of some of the points of presence that we have. These access costs range from anything between 5 million to 30 million. So the point of access is a very simple piece of equipment, but a very costly one. As these POPs are within the secure environment of ESCOM, these are the access points that we inherited from ESCOM. There was a need for us to actually ensure that those are secured. Without gathering our funds around, for this financial year, we are planning to ensure that we cover a certain of those that we believe are at a medium risk, because they are still protected within some of the territories of ESCOM. And from an internet protocol point of view, our network that is IP compliant within the Golden Triangle, where there is high volume, which is between Joseph, Devon, and Midtown, and we intend to extend that to some of the other networks. From a broadband policy target point of view, the target talks to broadband access in megabits per second of user experience. What we have done in the year for which we reported is that there was an upgrade on the Northern Ring where we increased capacity from 160 gigabits per second to 480, in simple terms expanding the highway of telecommunications even in specific areas. We also upgraded access of our network that are touching through Eastern Cape, KZN, Gauteng, Western Cape, and Northern Cape across the province from 40 gigs to 80 gigs, and in some of the areas, 120 gigs. And for the SADC region, what people may say that even traffic, our connectivity with Zimbabwe is at 40 gigs. And we are hoping that by the end of the financial year, we will be at 80 gigs. What this means is that even with the limited funds that we had, we have been able to renew 40% of our network. So we took over a network that had 80% of obsolete equipment. Of that 80% with the project that we had, we've renewed 40% of it to the next generation. On top of this, we have budgeted to spend 269 million rand in our capex. We spent 290, which is 81% compared to the previous year where we had spent 1.3 million. Year on year, there's been a 52.4% increase in terms of our capex spend. I will not go into the details of all of our provincial engagements, but we will go straight into the results for the year that we are in. From a revenue point of view, members, we invested into West Africa Cable System as a tier one investor in order to ensure that the country is ready for the SKA project. So our previous executive authority facilitated the process to ensure that the Department of Science and Technology, now that the SKA has been awarded, that takes up the capacity on the West Africa Cable System that has assisted us with the cash that has come through. We have been able to connect customers, but I must indicate that, of course, for us to have the revenue, we must also have an understanding of our costs within the company. Our strategy has been focusing on building capability and competencies within the organization, growing the revenue and expanding the network. With the resources that we've been able to bring on board, we have been able to review the pricing that we have. We are aware that, fully aware that our initial customer pricing for one specific customer, it is low cost. The contract has been written. What has been incorporated in the contract is price decline that is too steep in terms of the downward trend. From a shareholder contact point of view, we achieved 96% of us. The 4% that we did not achieve relates to economic transformation, specifically to procurement of services from youth and from people with disabilities. I'll talk to that when I go through the contact. We do have an unqualified audit. There are matters that have been raised, and one has to do with the Construction Industry Development Board, the CIDB, where the external auditors indicated that we needed to comply. And once we engaged with them, we further engaged with CIDB post the period to indicate that we appreciate that telecommunications is 70%, construction 8% telecommunications. So we needed to know which aspect of the CIDB should we be complying with. So we are engaging the CIDB, and that's going to be a continuing engagement. And we are hoping that by the end of the financial year, we have resolved that specific matter. Another one has got to do with the basic financial issues where I suppose we do have an interim CFO. Where we have been providing for during the year we were reporting on, and at the end of the financial year we had settled on that matter. But at the point of finalizing our report, that was not expensed as such. We conduct an employee satisfaction survey, an independent third party, and out of that 70%, we got a 70% satisfaction rate. We come from a background where the employee morale was very low, and there's a lot of interventions that have been put in place to address that. We also assess the
the satisfaction of our customers through independent third party, and the satisfaction rate of our customers came at 3.5 versus 3 of the industry norm. Going into our shareholder compact from a financial sustainability level, instead of just measuring revenue, because revenue is as a result of the network being utilized, there was limited understanding previously that when you run a network, for you to be able to have one link to provide a service level of 99.95, you probably need two routes going the same way, so that when one route is down, one route can always be up. So the board and the shareholder agreed that we should be measured on utilization of our network, because if our network is utilized, then we'd be generating revenue. So we achieved on that specific target, very focused. The near-term contract was in 2012, the contracts that we have in place, they provide with us a positive net present value, and the business cases do make sense. We were expected to develop a financial plan, which we have a very hard implementing in this financial year, and that included sourcing funds, whether be it from development finance institutions, commercial banks, and also engaging the executive authority. From a stakeholder management, I've already spoken about the customer survey. I've spoken about the employee survey. I've indicated about the network expansion that we've had, and I've talked about the collaboration with other state-owned entities. From an economic transformation point of view, the amount of money spent on black-owned enterprises, spent on black-owned entities, women-owned entities, youth-owned entities, and people with disabilities. For the youth-owned and people with disabilities, I think we put together a strategy, and like colleagues from other entities have said, we've developed an enterprise development strategy that we are now implementing, where we require additional information from our suppliers, and where we are able to indicate to the OEMs, to where the suppliers or smaller entities that are on our database. So as I present the report for last year, I am pretty comfortable that for the youth-owned entities, we should be able to achieve our targets going forward. We're still working very hard to ensure that we achieve our targets for people with disabilities going forward. As part of building capability, there has to be leadership training for the first level of management, which is the executive, the second level, which is senior management, and there are competencies that we have identified to be critical that employees are trained on. And the board approved our HR development strategy, and in this financial year, we are implementing the strategy that we agreed on last year. Our training spend for the year looks significantly high, but that's because we were able to push and agree with our OEM that with the amount of money that we do spend with them, and considering the new project, industrial participation, where we spend a huge amount of money, we do believe that a lot of money also has to be spent on ensuring that our own people are skilled, or South African-owned entities are skilled. From an indirect job point of view, we have put forward plans to see how we measure those going forward, and in this current year, we are measuring those. I will hand over to the CFO.
So I suppose evening is appropriate, but evening, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, Deputy Minister, colleagues. Just run through the income statement, and you know, you people call it a statement of financial performance, but it's really an income statement. If we just cover not everything, like as the CEO has pointed out, our revenue grew 27% from 237 to 302. But what is important to note is that in 2012 our revenue was 394 million, and that 394 million was the majority of one client taking out that 367, was one client, and 27 was others. That 367 has declined to 189. So you can see, although we still have the same capacity, the revenue is declining at an alarming rate from one customer, and we have to find other revenue to supplement that. What helped us in 2014 is that the West African cable system was online, and we managed to sell 69% of that to the Department of Science and Technology, or CSIR, for the SAA project. And that brought us 56 million rand in revenue, and then our revenue grew to 57 million from 40 million. Good news on the cost of sales line, the cost of sales declined from 276 to 172 to 153, and the gross profit for the current year is 149 versus 65, quite substantially up on the previous year, which is good news for us. Operating expenses went up quite significantly to 312, but that's explained by various interventions as well as some other costs that we incurred. Leaving our income before interest to 163 negative versus 187, slight improvement, or at least a 30 million improvement on the previous year. Finance income fairly static at 20 versus 22, but we had a substantial more money available in 2012 to have 34 million rand worth of interest. So on a profit, or loss for the year rather, our loss is 143 for the current year versus 175 versus 95 previous year. You can see the impact that the revenue had that we lost off. Just as a note, we reviewed our useful life of some of our assets, set our optic transmission and network assets, and we restated our depreciation for the previous year at 7 million. So if you look at our financials of the previous year, the annual report of the previous year, you'll see the loss for the year is 181 as opposed to 175. If you look at our balance sheet, fairly static in terms of where what makes up our balance sheet. Cash 529 in 2011, 442 in 2014, still substantial cash available. What's different from the previous year is our cases sitting at 360 million, and that's 300 million of that 360 million consists of a outstanding debtor, the Department of Science and Technology, or CSIR, owes us 300 million, which was paid in June of 2014. So, leaves us with 60 million. Normal debtors runs around between 30 and 35 million, and that's where it's at. And included in there is a long-term repayment for the use of dark fiber from a company called Dark Fiber Africa, and it's a 13-year IRU. And we have these IRUs in the industry so that we can reduce our long-term cost, but it does mean that you have to lay out cash up front sometimes. Assets, very static, 1291, you can see the increase in assets and depreciation is very similar to previous years. So our asset base is a system of just under 1.3 billion, and in that 1.3 billion is probably 600 million attributable to the West African cable system. If you look at our liabilities, 275 current liabilities, and included in that 275 is 110 million for the optical transmission system that we upgraded the market that came in towards the end of the financial year and we grew for it, as well as a settlement arrangement with Neotel for services used of about 53 million. That owed to the SARS on the West African cable system of 20 million. And then all credit is around 40 million, that makes up the 275, which is quite a large number. Then we look at long-term liabilities or deferred income, 610 million. Of that 610, approximately 500 million is attributable to the 15-year CSIR IRU agreement. And then we've got quite a lot of other settlements, notably APN, Vodacom, AirUPID, that is sign Hong Kong IRU services with us, and that makes us majority of that 610 million. If we look at the equity, we call equity 1.2 million. It really consists of the shareholders' loans from our from government, or previously we used from the Department of Public Enterprises, which I suppose we now the Department of Post and Telecommunication Services, and our other shareholder, the IDT, who's a 26% shareholder in Broadland and Fractal. And that's the original seed capital, less the losses that we've incurred since establishment. Quick look at our cash flow. As you can see, our cash flows are fairly steady, 442 million in 2014, and substantially because of half the payment of the 300 million that came from CSIR. And we're probably going to use a lot of that capex to a lot of that cash to meet our capex. Cash from operations, 329, 300 million is attributable to CSIR. Cash used in investing activities, you can see 2011 of the 577 substantially our contribution to be a tier one shareholder in the West African cable system, and then normal, and then 189 in 2014, which the CEO previously explained, a quite substantial increase from the previous year, but although still below what we anticipated. Cash from financing activities, originally 2011, injection of 187 million with the additional capex assets that was contributed. There was really nothing, and the 2013 and 2014 is just a correction of a accounting statement and misunderstanding between the IDC, what the IDC meant with the contribution. So that's really just a correction in a way. So we had no other income for financing activities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Shall we take the comments and questions? Shall we get a microphone before you move? Let's take Honorable McKenzie. Do you have a Honorable Dane, Honorable Fotik?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to the Stable Broadband Infraco. Just as a general comment, if you'll permit me, I particularly like your cooperation with private sector companies like Dark Fiber Africa, because they're kind of works towards the NDP and its public-private partnerships, if you like, and they seem very much like that. They have a state-owned company, they're cooperating with the private sector to make sure that we don't duplicate infrastructure in areas. So I think that's a very positive development. Onto your annual report. Well done on meeting your targets. If you meet your targets so accurately, clearly you've given them a lot of thought, and perhaps you should set the bar a bit higher next time, because you've certainly achieved nearly all of them. In terms of your customer base, I noticed that Neotel utilize 62% now of your network, having been your sole customer in 2009. What steps have you taken to mitigate that risk and that revenue dropping even further? And do you have any idea about how much that will be in this financial year? As far as your cooperation with Isasa goes, I don't think the chairperson of the committee would appreciate my comments, so I will reserve that one. At what point do you anticipate your company actually turning a profit? Becoming profitable, because that would be a healthy development in line with the other horses in our stable. Seems to be doing well in that regard. In terms of your employee expenses, I see that your salaries went up from 79 million to 104 million. And as far as I can see, you employed 22 new people. Is that as a result of those new employees as well as normal salary increases? If you could just confirm that for me. I attended the Broadband 2014 conference this year, and you had a marketing presence. And let me compliment your staff, that man, that stand. They were very professional, they were certainly very knowledgeable, and they were interacting quite widely with all the companies and the people that were there. So I thought that was a very worthwhile exercise. And they were very knowledgeable. I didn't identify myself in the beginning. We had an extensive conversation about what they were doing there. And they certainly knew their stuff. But I noticed that your marketing has dropped substantially from 10 million down to just under 3 million. They say the wisest businesses in tough economic times invest more in marketing to gain more market share rather than less. So I'd be interested to know your thinking behind the decline in your marketing spend. And then on page 100 of your annual report, both in the 2013 and 2014 reports, there's a comment on expenditure in the transgression of commercial processes and policies. You say matters are in the process of being ratified, and that appears four times, but there doesn't seem to be any progress or any ratification. So if you could just give me some information on that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. We have welcome on board the new baby. Okay, I've got only two questions. Can you please clarify the status of the opposition, and can you conclude that there are no vacancies in the entity? Improvements and wasteful expenditure is reflected by the Auditor General report. What are the main mitigation factors to avoid this happening in the future? Which is a turnaround strategy? Thank you.
I'm also welcoming the new baby. The second thing, as I like the fact that you actually have the first time and to say who are you indeed. Unfortunately, you're getting to office. We take ownership of the good and the bad. So you're going to be answerable to all the best things that you're going to raise here, as much as to benefit from the glory that you find, whatever the good thing in the new office. My concern arises from page 68 of the master topic. Annual report on page 68. The liability management and the procurement. If you can explain why the DB procurement process was not followed on construction contracts, and same goes for project and waste expenditure. According to the ACES report, the MTD has a reflex vendor. In fact, the transgression of commercial voters and policies. Can you get the explanation to the subject for now? Okay, maybe next time, when the MTD is now old, we have more questions.
That's fine. I think for me, CEO and board chairperson in the future, looking at the performance against the shareholder compact, target has been achieved, though at some point, like you were saying, the 4%. I think what gives me comfort is the reflection of the transformational issues that we talk about. And I think this is also one entity, but I've not picked it up in only other entities, where there's even internship programs that you've got. And this is what I addressed with the previous entity. Those are the things I would like, and I'd like to comment you on that one, because I think it really assists in terms of what we want to achieve. I hope you would be able to just put in place. I know you said, but I couldn't cut what is it that you're going to do to at least to close this gap, because you said it's only on the youth and the disabled that you're not able to achieve the target. But for me, these are the critical areas in terms of what we talk about in the issue of transformation. Then, the second issue I want to speak to, okay. Yeah, I think what about the intent, I think it's on page 49 that you have reflected on. In terms of page 46, 2.7, your challenges in the report, and maybe it goes to the DG communication. Here, Professor Dylan was not invited to be part of the review panel, ICT review panel. Not so sure what the cost of the been there, and she is playing that role, they should have been part of it. But it's reflected here. What happened, and are they already included now? Because I'm worried that it means if we have an ICT process that has started with and has left one of the critical areas behind, there might be implications of that. I'm just worried about that, picking it up from what is raised. But again, CEO, page 47, again, you are raising the issue of absence of an individual electronic communication service person. Unable to balance the field of the work capability, which is national law system offering inability by the capability of an end-to-end solution to its customers, specifically as they think affecting revenue generating efforts. How do we get out of this? Any plans? Are there engagements? Where is the stumbling block on this matter? Because I think that will assist us, because if we highlight challenges, do we have a possible solution or what do we need to ask? Because at times it might be that the entity that accounts in Parliament that we can simply interact and understand from them. And then the other issue that I make clear to me is page 64. Revenue loss to service migration. I try to find some notes on it. Maybe if you can just explain to us what is it meant then. Then we come, okay, the issues raised by the AG colleagues have raised them. I think for me as well, again, sentiments that have been echoed to other entities, adherence to the law becomes a critical issue, and therefore we've got to ensure every time CFO and CEO that we do that, we ensure that adherence to the law. Then I need explanation on page 17. I tried to go to the notes because we've got some notes there. The issue of accumulated deficit and spent income. And then again, 872, loss for the year, the amount of it, CFO, if it can be explained, and what has been the cause of that loss. And then I come to page 94, CEO and CFO, and then maybe the board chair. Key management members of the executive, in terms of the heading there is around remuneration and especially on bonuses. And the footnote there, with the first one and the only one, the third one there, this relates to the bonuses paid for the 2012-2013 financial year. The 2013-2014 financial year bonuses are set. Note 12 will be approved by the accounting of which the AGM in August 2014. But I'm just looking at the amount, if I'm not wrong, this is a million, 69 million. It's got three asterisks, which goes with the footnote. That's what I'm reading together with the footnote there. It's an album. Oh, I wanted to show that it's 69 million. So that we are very clear in terms of the amount that you're talking about. And then, okay, if that's the case, there was something I picked up, I'm trying to find it, what is, in terms of the payment of the CFO or as a consultant, I can't remember where I put the names on. I remember the page, because it looks like I didn't mark, I've marked as issue, but this one specifically I didn't mark. which is a bit of a concern for me. Why was the CFO at a time as 8? Because it was 18 CFO, and that's what I'm trying to find it. Don't know what it is with that piece. And you are saying in terms of the report, is paid as a consultant or consultant fee. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I find it because I remember I saw it in my notes. I should be wrong. Oh yeah. On the same page, interim CFO is remunerated on a consultancy basis through NSNIA. Just want to understand why was that done, because I think should have been just a CFO being appointed or somebody found in the internal. What was and you have to assist us, and because the issue for us, and I think either whether it's good for you or it's bad for me, it could be another CFO CEO and approach. Because the chairman of this annual report was that we were not able to go to the committee of public enterprise to find details and verify. So something that is good or bad is another issue. But that's why some of the things we are able to compare, we have noted with other entities, we are able to get them through to say over this period of time, this is how you speak for me. So I just wanted to alert you, we are going to do that analysis. Once you have completed, we might come back to you and do something about the issue.
Thank you very much. I think to a large extent, Sheraton, you have covered most of the issues that I wanted to flag. This is a high-tech part of the ICT value chain. I just wanted to begin building the economic aspects of it. It's really the serious effort, which we appreciate. But you know that coming to funding component, I just wanted to hear from maybe the board or the CEO whether in terms of the shareholder compact, how much scope have you got to look at other sources of funding? Because I can't imagine partnering, because I see in terms of going forward, if you were to partner with the private sector, it can create challenges. If you have too many stop and goes in terms of not having funding from public funds that you require, and then and yet having contractual obligations, I don't know whether there's a thinking about or you are allowed to look at alternative forms of funding if you have credible clients who are contracted to you to deliver the services, especially if your networks to build the networks might be labor intensive, cost intensive, and create problems to support. Thank you.
In the presentation, you say that you've got 13,000 kilometers of geographic coverage. Your annual report is 14,000. Can you tell us which one of those is correct? And then this map that you have here of the network, is that network as it is now, is that everything that you've got in the ground? Or is there some components of it that haven't been installed yet? It looks like a very extensive network. I just want to know whether that wish list or whether that actually is reality. Thank you. And then also just sort of wanting to know the challenges that you have. I haven't had time to read your annual report that you may have with local provincial authorities, sort of for local wages and other things, if there's been any improvement. Yes.
Two things for me that I forgot, my apologies. The issue of credit cards, I missed that one. The Auditor General is raising that credit cards were not used for permitted purposes as per Treasury regulations. I need to understand what is it. And I think DM raised the issue. Clarify the issue because we've got to raise an opinion on what you're saying on your audit, on your annual report, not just for your request for capital injection. If you can just allow me to clarify, because we've got to be able to say something around that, because we have made it, we can't quite as a community, very quite certified to be able to express an opinion either in support or against
So I just need to really elaborate on it.
One of the credit cards, or just ask my parents how much does he care in terms of rent and things as a result of the carelessness. The credit card is there, it's just a little change. The same question, how much does he care because of the carelessness? Yeah.
You are better.
Sorry, I'm going to go back and divide the questions. I'm going to speak to the issue of the CFO and I guess the issue of the DDNS license, how we could be assisted. The issue of the DDNS license comes from our own parents. We had tried many years to try and obtain it and we had tried to get the ministerial decree to obtain it. We haven't been able to. I think we also applied through the long way with the CASA. We have not been successful on the issue. So if the House could assist, we would welcome that. The issue of payment of the CFO via Ernst & Young, the consultant, arose when our CFO resigned, and the process to fill the vacancy took longer than was expected. What happened was we were presented with candidates, and those candidates didn't really quite fit the bill, and we had to redo the process. And then in the process, there was a change in the ministry also. Before Mr. Kigalo could approve what appointment we recommended, then Mr. Brown came in. That also hindered the process. So that's how we found ourselves in this position. But that has been completed. I think effectively, 1st November, the appointed CEO commences his duty. I think that's what I am able to cover. The credit card, the CEO and CFO can speak to that together with the funding and the answer to the Deputy Minister's question around what is it that we can do insofar as private collaboration.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. The CFO will deal with the financial matters. With regards to the drop in marketing expenses, when executive authority tells you, you need to manage your costs, manage them accordingly. So what we then decided to do is to be really focused and focus on interventions that would be of value to us. So whilst last year, we need to ensure that we focus internally and ensure that we have our ducks in a row. For the financial year, we will be spending the money, but not to the extent that we did in the previous financial year. There are vacancies in the entity. There is a vacancy of an executive level of a chief marketing and sales officer. We have an acting officer. There is a vacancy of chief operating officer. The chief marketing and sales officer emanates from the incumbent having left the company. The chief operating officer position was only ratified by the board in this financial year. So we're working on ensuring that we define fully what we have to do before we go out advertising, but we also consider the issues of affordability for the entity. So we may advertise, we will definitely advertise the same position within the next 3 weeks, but not necessarily the CEO position, because I think that position, because it wasn't approved and was approved late into the year, we'll have to adjust for it in the next financial year, whereas the CMSO position is adjusted for in the year that we are in. We do have challenge in terms of filling technical positions. And I think those are positions that are very critical to us, like the engineers and the technicians. So we come up with a strategy that we are very thorough in our appointment of our interns, so that we are able to absorb them. So every 2 year cycle, we would then be able to bring in the interns, because we spend a lot of time and money training them to be a specific level. Bringing in people at a higher level becomes quite a challenge, because we fight for the skills of companies that are listed that offer shares as incentives to their employees. So we believe that if we train our people, and then the scope for them to move up. And that's also a strategy for us to use from an employment equity point of view, because the CEO of Centech talked about females within the sector. It is also our own challenge. So for our next cycle of interns, we intend to aggressively look for young female engineers to bring up into the organization so that we can train them. It's very difficult to find them when they are in senior positions. They are talented, because the golden goods for those companies who also want to comply with employment equity. The issue of the CIDP, as I indicated, we did vote, or we wrote the fiber on the polls. And the auditors are saying we must comply as well as building the assembly. There are two different issues of construction. We are constructing in a very specific way, which is why we have engaged the CIDB to say, under which section should we be compliant, so that we can be fully compliant. We have made a submission in that regard. Whilst for the bigger companies, this might be an easier target to achieve. We have realized, again, I referenced the CEO of Centech, where he said when we got in companies to look at a size, when we looked at the size of what they needed to, the entity didn't work up. For one specific project in Durban, we wanted local enterprises. We advertised locally in Durban. We advertised the same tender 2 times to try and localize the procurement, and we could not necessarily get like old enterprises that do that. Just because we have a CIDB to do big construction services doesn't mean that you deal with telecommunications and the specifications that are required there. So in that instance, we were able to agree a sharing with a bigger company that was doing that to partner with female-owned entities, so that next time we have a bigger database to work from. So this issue of the CIDB is something that we will continue to engage the CIDB itself. We are awaiting their response, and we are going to work hard on ensuring that we comply. It only means that we put that as a condition in the tender that we issue up, but it also does mean a restriction in terms of our transformational goals that we want to achieve. So we are still seeing and trying to create a balance on that. The transformational target, it was difficult previously because we didn't have a clear defined strategy. We do have a clear defined strategy, and as indicated, we are on track to achieve our youth bond procurement, but we do have a challenge with people with disability. That's where, Madam Chair, we are working very hard to do that. In terms of the policy review, it was quite a challenge for us to have been in the Department of Public Enterprises and not necessarily having full sight of what was happening on the policy environment. And I think that our move into the department would aid us to a sight of all of those engagements. The ECS license, as much as it is part of the Act, I am aware that there were previous engagements between the department, the then Department of Communications, Portfolio Committee and the Portfolio Committee of Public Advertisers, and I believe this engagement with the executive authority. But from outside, if I may just indicate, Microsoft, as an example, had wanted to use us. They wanted to have a career neutral entity and wanted to move traffic between themselves, and for us to actually connect to them as an entity that is going to be utilizing that information, we do actually need an ECS license. We have made an application to ICASA for the license, even though there was no invitation to apply for the license. And we have been informed that we will be getting an ECS license. So what we are now doing is exploring from the other SOCs can utilize the ECS licenses that they have, because all of the entities in the state do have both ECS and ECNS. We only have an ECNS license. So to ensure that we don't continue losing revenue, because that's our challenge. For international connectivity, those people just want to connect and buy capacity and use it for themselves without reselling it. They require to have a partner. We do have Google as a customer. It took quite a while for us to connect them because we don't have an ECS license. So they had to identify a partner in South Africa that they could work with that has got an ECS license. So it is a challenge for us as we speak. The revenue loss and the financial ones, the CEO will talk to them, as well as the bonuses and the credit cards. And from a funding point of view, our funding plan required us to be able to engage various entities, whether it is DFIs or commercial banks. As an example, one of the commercial banks indicated to us that a cost of debt of charge 7.58 for 500 million over 5 years, but a condition for that was a guarantee. And that's because of the status of our balance sheet as it is. They are aware that we do have the project, we engage them on those specific projects. The issue of automated forms of funding, again, for us, my commercial funders would want their money back within a very short period of time. So the alternative for us to go for development finance institutions with lower rates and longer payment terms. But to be able to engage those DFIs again, we need both the executive authority and the National Treasury to be able to agree on that. We did submit an MTF with the previous executive authority. We shall wait for responses on that. On the question of the 13,000 kilometers on the presentation and approximately 14,000 that is in the annual statement, the presentation is correct. Where we are as right now, we are closer to the 14,000 and we will reach that. The annual report has said approximately 14,000. We have had to audit that. The challenges with regard to the local and provincial authority is a major one. Being the new kid on the block, the executive authority has requested a representative to indicate to them what it is that we are doing with the provinces, which we will be submitting to them tomorrow. One is the point of entry within the province, that is a challenge. If in some provinces, for example, you have a Department of Finance having an element of broadband, then you have a Department of Economic Development doing the same thing, and then you have a Department of Infrastructure doing the same thing, it becomes very difficult to be able to engage in this kind of environment to say where exactly is the strategy. What we have done, because to a certain level we have engaged with all of the provinces to classify the provinces, if I mean make an example with the province of the Northwest and the Northern Cape. In those provinces you will find that broadband is part of the GITO forum, which is totally different from what you need to actually do for an infrastructure. So we need to journey with them and make them understand where we're coming from and where they are coming from. In provinces like Limpopo and Mpumalanga, it's driven through the economic development unit. And the reason it is done that way is because then they would bring in the demand side department, whether it's your education, your social development, your health, and all of that. That's what the engagement would have been. But we do need serious support in the engagement with the province. I think post our submissions to the executive authority, probably because all of the entities are engaging in various forms, as of that, we probably will find out, come up with a framework of how we actually engage with them. It does depend at which level we engage and where we engage, because the engagement has to start at an MEC level with the HOD. Some provinces have got dedicated people looking at broadband. Some of the smaller provinces, which would be a challenge, do not have such people on board. So they must still work on developing their own specific strategy to that effect. The local municipalities, I think we have engaged with the board on this. What is important for us is South Africa Incorporated to have one network plan. And out of that network plan, you can roll out, allow people to roll out different aspects of that network, but we work on one thing. We need to guard against the technology that is being put up so that it is scalable and it is not necessarily something in our country. But it also has to be fit for purpose. You can't go where you have very minimal traffic and go and put a Rolls Royce in that area. But you must put infrastructure in there that will work. And also what is important is that while fiber is critical, in some of the areas we are going to have to look at other forms of connectivity because of low population densities and probably of the cost and the return on that. Because this entire fiber thing, the funding of it, does not necessarily become a challenge only for the public sector, it's a challenge for the private sector. High demand in data means high expenses on the local, on the last mile. Broadcom on the 9 pillars, and that's just on the access side. Changing the radio access network so that we can be able to use our smartphones and our tablets easily. But we still have the challenge. You still need a whole lot of fiber, but where fiber is not required, you've got to say what are the ultimate sources of broadband, whether it's the spectrum availability at 802.6 also becomes important. The issue of irregular expenditure, before I hand over to the CFO, there is an outstanding matter that has been running year in, year out for 130 million rand. It was investigated. Employees were charged and left the organization. Actually, one final court case was analyzed this week in the labor court. An appeal process was finalized. So that's how long it's taking us. And from the CMA, we went to the labor court with a ruling which was appealed. So that's finalized. So as executive management, we have to then call in the OAG to complement the work that had been done by the forensic investigators at that time. We presented the information to the board, and we hope that that would be condoned. In due course, that we don't carry it on us in perpetuity. What is it that we are doing to address irregular expenditure? Our policy was written as though it's that of a department, rather than infrastructure player. He does feel the field accordingly. The policy is being socialized. The entire procurement environment has been re-engineered. People have had to reapply for jobs, people in the positions that were appropriate, they all have to go through six testing before they were placed into those specific positions. That process started in February and it had been completed. But most critically, segregation of duties, separating demand planning and procurement, because we had a situation where a procurement specialist would work on a project from specification to award without clear demarcation of responsibility. So that is totally separated right now in the environment within itself. The policy has been approved in April and has planned to socialize the policy within the organization, because it's one thing to write the policy, it's another thing to ensure that the employees understand what is required of them. So with an expectation that by the third quarter, at least we should have covered the critical areas, especially those where we spend most of our money, which is the core of the business, which is the technical aspect of the business. We also have identified what is core and what is non-core, core meaning those services we procure because they add on to our network and they are high value. So that again assists us in ensuring that we put proper governance in place. For our tenders, we've instituted a process where before a tender is awarded, we are able to audit and ensure that there's compliance within those specific processes. CFO.
Thank you, CEO. I hope I've remembered what are the remaining questions. I think the first one goes to our first associated with having one sole customer and the customer base. I just want to remind honourable members to a slide that we showed that in 2009 we had one customer, which was Newcal at the time. That has since grown to 14, although the customer's contribution to revenue is not in the same league as what it was with Newcal, because essentially in the beginning Newcal utilized a large part of our network. In this current financial year, we have gone to great lengths to secure two anchor clients with substantial contribution to revenue into the future, and that will only gradually come through over a period of time. But I think the strategy to reduce the liability of Newcal to contribute to revenue, as well as Newcal strategy and probably go to combine it as well, will have an impact on the organization, and we've gone to great lengths to mitigate that, I think. The expected drop in revenue, if we just look at the contribution in 2012, Newcal contributed 367 million to our revenue of 394. In 2014, that 367 is reduced to 189, and it's expected to further decline by another 40-odd million to 134 in 2015. And then gradually, when over the term of the MSA, which has got another 2 years to run, 2.5 years to run, new health revenue will drop to just below 100 million in the final year, unless they increase certain services that they acquire from us. So that's the one point. I think the Honourable Mayor also asked at what point will be turning a profit. I think you need to, so a simple answer, you need to put the broadband in context and the way infrastructure operates. There's a high upfront cost, that's why the need for CapEx and funding. The company has got a high fixed cost in certain aspects. The fixed cost ratio is up to 70 and 80% in certain aspects, as well as getting the depreciation is a large substantial part of your cost, for your salary, you need people to run the network. So the only way you're going to improve the profitability is to increase revenue. And at this stage, based on our previous, our current corporate plan for the next 5 years, in 2.5 years' time, we'll be EBITDA positive, okay? And probably in another year after that, we'll be contributing to profitability. But that means we're going to have to build the network as we anticipate, so that we have the critical mass to sign up new customers. And it's important, connectivity prices do drop, so we had a lot of strain to match cost pressures. Also the impact funding, that's quite serious in our business. So if we achieve our targets, and this is the bar higher, if we achieve the targets, 2.5 years' time we'll be EBITDA positive, and probably by middle of year 3 or 4, we should be contributing positive profit if we achieve the revenue target that we set out and we manage the cost appropriately. If we look at the employee expenses, and just to explain, if you go to our annual report, our employee expenses for 2013 was 86.140 million. Excluded from that figure is the amount of 6 million that was supposed to be for the bonus provision for the previous financial year. A provision was not made. So if you buy 2013, taking into account that you should have provided for the bonus because the company potentially met some of its targets in the previous year and people were entitled to a bonus, that's a reduction of 6 million. So your base figure for 2013 is around 82 million. Our total cost for 2014, for the March period ending March 2014, is 110.2 million, so an increase of around 18.3 million roughly. Okay. We have, because of our quality and members have noted that we achieved almost 96% of our performance targets, so we had to pay a bonus in the current year. The auditors was of the opinion that because we are going to pay a bonus, we had to provide for it, so that was a rate adjustment in our account. So we provided 8.3 million in our financials. So the increase of 8.3 of that is the bonus provision for the financial year, which is setting the results now. So the increase all in all is 10 million, roughly about 11%, 12% on the base of the previous year. Our staff numbers did grow to just under 170 on average, as well as the inflation adjusted cost, so between 6.5% and 8%, and the company also unionized by trust. That explains the employee cost moving from 86 to 110 in the current year. If we just deal with the question on page, sorry, Chief, on page 669,000, that's the attributable portion of bonuses for the executives for the previous financial year. Because the current financial year is a general provision, that's not included in that cost at this stage. Our revenue loss service migration, sorry, Chair. If you understand our business a little bit more, you will find that we sell those gigabytes we have in our network with different configurations. STM1 is a sort of the base, and it's a certain amount of gigabytes. And as you progress, you've got an STM8, STM16, STM32, STM64, because it just increases a little speed. So the different product combinations is this ATM, as we call it. The revenue loss means that a customer may currently have a ATM1 configuration, and we want to up it to an SEM 32 or SEM 64 configuration. So that means a change in Megalite, but you give the customer the benefit of the doubt, because then they renew the contract for a much longer period, because we normally sign either 12, 18 or 24, even longer revenue contracts, MSA contract with customers. So how we account for that product cost from the base is just to explain the migration of customers in between the product lines. If we go to the question on deferred income, as I said in the presentation, we normally, or in some cases, we sell our network services or connectivity on an IRU basis, an individual right of use basis, and some of those contracts are between 10 and 15 years. And the reason my customers want it for such long periods is because they get a price that declines over time, takes account of time value of money. But if they pay up front, they get the benefit of a cheap price over time. So what will happen is we, and in the case of the WAC, sale of 6,528 million to DSC, we will get the cash in upfront in reality, but you only account for the revenue in your income statement over the period of the lease or the IRU that you signed. And in this case, that 500 million, the bulk of it will be written off over 15 years. So in your income statement, you just write it off over the period of the contract. Page 72, loss for the year. I think the loss for the year is covered on page 71. What makes up the loss? I think page 72, it's just the changes in how the losses is affected equity, but the loss of 143.44 is made up really because our solvency, we improved on a gross profit level, but our cost is quite significantly higher, and 302, our revenue isn't at the point of break even, probably need revenue of around 500 million per annum plus, and that's the reason really why we suffered a lot today. Page 9 for the key management remuneration bonuses, I think I've covered that. And now what I've got on my list to manage is the credit card. Honourable members and honourable chair, we employ the use of credit cards to manage peak cash for our regions by and large. Something like 13 regions is pretty much away from Danton, from where our offices are, and occasionally they need to utilize costs to acquire certain goods and services, and we've been employing credit cards to allow them to purchase these goods and services, and we requested from National Treasury for an exemption. We've been advised that it will not be allowed, we have to comply, and are now implementing practices to ensure that these credit cards are no longer in use and that we find an alternative way to deal with services and incidentals for the regions on a centralized basis. I think I've covered everything. I'm not sure we missed out.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. If I may just explain again on just to add on to the Chair's comment about why the CFO is a consultant. When the CFO resigned, and by January I ended to have a CFO. But not only did I have the CFO resign, I had a financial manager resigning at the same time, which presented itself with a challenge. And with that, I then engaged the board and opted for the comment from the audit firm 3 months before financial year and without two difficult positions. So we needed to ensure that we bring people on board that would ensure that we address whatever issues that we have and that we are ready for financial year end. On the issue of employee expenses and the bonuses, in case
2020, the bonuses that they pay out were the employee portion, because we have a consideration on our permanent management policy that says 70% of the incentive is on your own personal performance and 30% is on the company. So for that year, the board resolved not to pay anything with regards to company performance. For the year that has gone past, as much as we achieved 96%, which would have been 96%, 6% of 96% that would provide the employees with the funds. The board again emphasized that because of the financial targets and the financial situation of the company, we had to reduce that target as much as 96% was achieved. The payment was out at 86%. So it's been managing again the affordability, but ensuring that you you pay for the right behavior, but you also consider where the company is at. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I think it was two issues. The first one is on the IDP policy review. Chamber, do you want to say?
Yes, I think it was Chairperson. The SHG Policy Review Panel was appointed through a open process legislated in terms of Section 3 of the ECA. The entity did indicate interest because they omitted to submit the name. At that time, we advised them that because we ran a process to comply also with PAJA, they needed to engage the minister. We were expecting that BVI would in fact send a name through to the minister. I don't think that would have been a challenge. I am, however, aware that in the committees of the ICT Policy Review, BVI is participating. I also of the view that it's not late for BVI to participate, because this is a very important process that in fact would benefit them, and the country will contribute, will benefit from their contribution. So it's not late, and my DG is also here, and the Deputy Minister.
Just add on the issue of the individual license of ECS, we are quite familiar with the matter. I think what I said to Timber is we need to read the matter again with the Prime Minister and see how we can deal with it. Yeah, we'll read it with the Minister.
No, the issue on diligence period, for me the concern becomes if one entity that needs to play a role is left out, and I'm glad because I think it would work for the BVI as well, to the advantage that they're now in the same, because you would likely have the duplication in the process because of the, if they're left out of the process, they're left out of the policy guidance and policy work, then they can go on a different direction, whereas everybody else is going towards the other direction. And that will disadvantage them, but it will disadvantage government, because we'll end up challenging money in one thing in different areas. I don't know if that makes sense, and we'll end up with duplication. So I think now there is an opportune moment that we should be able not only on the IDG review, but on all the other policies, on the e-government, just in terms of defining the role of broadband in FRACO-PI within the central department. How are the drivers of the broadband in South Africa connected? What becomes their major role so that we define the things? I'm raising this thing as you are in Chairperson and people, specifically because for us it's critical if we to support your future plans. From the department point of view, we need to be very clear what role I'm playing. And what is it that you are envisaged going forward to be able to do within this level in terms of the work? So if you have, you started doing something else as well, there's what level of connecting, providing the network in the remote areas as per their mandate. We've got to try and really to define who does what and where, how do we supplement and complement each other. While noting that a lot of work in infrastructure has been invested by Procter & Gamble, how to either enhance the work that is being done or what are the things that are needed to be able to give them a PDI support that we should be able to enhance, because we all have to do our part. South Africa can be where it is in terms of the same in ICT globally if all of us are doing what we are supposed to be doing. So that's why I'm just making this comment, but as we go forward, we're going to need to try and really prioritize and have more conversations as a sector so that we're able to improve. I know that two hands that are raising and I'm going to give you each a second.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just 2 seconds. I know it's very late. Sorry, I wonder if you could assist me. The fiber lease costs, just so I can understand your business, went to 87 million and then got down to 43 million. And maintenance costs went up, I presume, because you've laid more fiber, it's more expensive to maintain. You've got to put money into that. So what are the fiber lease costs? Thank you. That's my last question. Thank you very much for all your questions.
Thank you, Chair. There was a ticket discussion with the Honourable Shin when we were presenting with the department on the discussion with regard to the rationalization, but because I think there were a lot of questions within this context. There are already discussions underway as part of implementing the South Africa Connect, because in the South Africa Connect there is a policy pronouncement on finding a way of rationalizing and SOCs. The discussions are still, of course, not concluded, so it's a matter the minister is handling. But what we are then saying in the short term is that we find ways where they can collaborate. But what we are finding or what we are observing is that since the proclamation, that since all of them are aware, it's much easier in terms of at least getting the new meetings or also finding ways where they can work together. For example, the issue that the CEO was talking about, one of the challenges that we had, we found that we would go to a province, we would be informed that Peter was here yesterday and then there's another meeting with the InfraCo the following day. So those are some of the things that we're trying to streamline in the short term. While they're separate entities, something that they can do to collaborate. And what we're appreciating is that the agreement between InfraCo and CISA, the discussions between InfraCo and CISA. So that process is ongoing. It will probably take us some time. But I think once the minister is ready, the deputy minister, they can come and proceed properly in terms of how we would move forward. Of course, this is more or less in line with, I don't know if you're aware, the presidential review on SOC, which more or less means things at a macro level. But what we're then saying is that at a micro level, as a sector, and as a department, what are we then saying with regard to the entities that are within our domain?
Thank you very much, Peter. The marriage between Rosen and Infacto in Utah, meant that we were using each other's network. So the reduction is cutting off the medical cord, where we had provided previously for infrastructure that we were using for Utah. But we had to audit rather than just agree to what we needed to pay them. So post the auditing, we negotiated a much lower price with much less kilometers of fiber, because they have a metro access network that is entangled to our network. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's after the normal day. That concludes our meeting. I wasn't sure I was going to have some time. I'd love it. Thank you very much. Those who are able to join the dinner arranged at the old assembly chamber and might go there. So the meeting budget will continue on Friday, members. We are meeting on Friday. We'll get our report and I'll explain the process from there on. Thank you very much, DM, for taking through and the department and the entities.